You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, brilliant and brainy, breathing bros and brontosauruses. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 126. And of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your cacophony of quiz-crunching cookie cohort co-hosts.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris. If you're not a bro, you're a brontosaurus.
Yes, pick a side.
Well. Quick listener thank you. I went to Penny Arcade Expo in Seattle the last weekend and met a couple of Good Job Brain listeners. One of them, his name is Kevin, and he gave me a stack of books for all of us, thus forming the seed or the genesis of the Good Job Brain library.
Which we all own
and none of us owns. One of the books of facts that he gave me is called A Hog on Ice and Other Curious Expressions. It's a book of where did colorful English language idioms come from.
That'd be helpful for me.
This is interesting. Baker's Dozen is in here. Baker's Dozen, of course, being 13 instead of, 12 loaves of bread or whatever. It says that in England, Parliament enacted a law in 1266 for regulating pieces of bread by weight with severe penalties for shorting somebody on the weight of loaves of bread. So, because bakers, rather than weigh everything, they would just throw in an extra loaf. Yeah, basically.
Just in case.
Yep. It became known as the inbred, I-N-B-R-E-A-D, or vantage loaf.
Okay.
The vantage loaf.
I like that.
Because it gave a vantage or a chance to the bakers to obey the law. It gave you an advantage. Advantage loaf.
Vantage loaf sounds like a business term, doesn't it?
Yeah, it totally does.
So the vantage loaf, we're going to capitalize on that.
So the 13th in a baker's dozen is known as the vantage loaf. Thank you very much, Kevin.
That's good.
That's a good pub quiz team name is Vantage Loaf.
People are like, what's that?
I will continue our housekeeping portion of the show before we get into the trivia. I have an installment of our omissions and errors segment, affectionately called...
Actually,
this is hands down my favorite actually that we've ever done.
Okay.
I had so much fun correcting and researching this one. So a couple episodes ago on the All About Butts episode, I was talking about etymologies of various butt and booty related words. Oh. And I had mentioned that the sources I had checked for Bootylicious showed that it was as late as 1998. And Dana, you were skeptical right when we were recording. And sure enough, we had more than one listener wrote in and said, I swear I could remember Snoop Dogg using the word bootylicious in the Dr. Dre song from The Chronic in 1993. So I decided to get to the bottom of bootylicious.
Thank you.
One of the advantages of having a wife who is in academia means that I have, by extension, access to the full OED, Oxford English Dictionary online.
I know that's a perk you love.
So, sure enough, I went on to OED online. Bootylicious.
Okay.
Adjective. Slang, originally United States. 1992.
Wow.
Snoop Doggy Dog from the song with Dre Day. There's a profanity in the title.
Oh, okay.
We'll just say it's Dre Day.
Okay. Yeah.
Them rhymes you were kicking were quite bootylicious.
Wow.
So not only dated to 1992, but credited to Snoop Dogg. He is the originator of record as far as the OED is concerned.
Mm.
And as I think listener Bobby pointed out, and as the OED notes as well, the original meaning, it wasn't like, in a sexual sense or anything good. He meant it as a slam. Like he was talking about another rapper. And when he's saying, your rhymes were bootylicious, he meant like
they're
bad.
Like butt.
Yeah.
Their official definition.
It tasted like butt.
Their official definition, bootylicious, bad or weak.
Like a butt.
Yeah. So it was not until later that it kind of took on the Destiny's Child meaning of bootylicious. Okay.
Right.
It's like, your rhymes taste like doo-doo. That makes sense.
Yeah. So there we go. 1992, documented. Snoop Dogg, thank you very much.
All right.
Another note from a listener. Listener Jenna made a comment on the blog post for our latest All Quiz Bonanza and pointed out something that I had no idea about, is that the quiz that I did, which was 13L in a BD.
Oh, the abbreviation quiz.
Right, the abbreviations quiz was actually created, as so many of these things are, by Will Shortz, crossword editor for the New York Times, and
Mr. Puzzles.
Yeah. Exactly, for Games Magazine back in the late 70s, early 80s.
Wow.
And as Jenna put it, it was rapidly sort of ripped off and shared without attribution as Xerox lore.
Yeah.
Xerox lore. That was a big thing.
Pre-internet.
Fax lore, they also kind of called it. The spreading of folk information and game and puzzles
Xerox
and humor by Xerox machines
Fax
and faxes.
Nobody updated it.
Awesome. All right. Well, that was a lot of housekeeping. Woo. Are you ready for our first general trivia segment? Pop quiz, hotshot.
30 minutes later.
All right. Here we go. I have a random Trivial Pursuit card, and you guys have your morning radio zoo buzzers. Here we go. Blue Wedge for geography. A branch of what art museum attracted over 1 million visitors to the Basque region of Spain in its first year of operation? Colin.
Oh, that's the Guggenheim in Bilbao.
Yes.
Whoa.
It is the Frank Gehry building, known as the wavy silver building.
Right, right.
All of his buildings
like
are
like many of the Frank Gehry buildings.
They're wavy. All right, Pink Wedge for pop culture. What animated buddies got their start mocking music videos on MTV? Everybody.
Beavis and Butthead. Oh, that would have been great for two episodes ago.
Yeah, that's true. That's random. It's random. Yep. Yellow Wedge. What last name did Melinda French take in 1994 when she wed her company CEO?
That would be Gates.
Yes. She married Bill.
Bill.
Yes.
Bill Gates.
Yep. Oh, no, I was just reading the note.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not being sassy.
Oh, it's in. Oh, God. Yeah,
there are a lot of notes on these cards these days. All right. Purple Wedge. What artist put a shark in formaldehyde, creating an artwork that eventually sold for $8 million? Colin knows this one.
I think that's Damien Hirst.
There's only one. Yep.
Holy cow.
That's him.
He, in fact, did do a cow as well.
Yep.
He's done some large scale.
The
sliced cow, right? Yeah. That was also Damien Hirst.
It's very weird and gross. All right. Green Wedge for science. What was the first animated feature film generated completely on computers? Colin.
I think that's usually credited as Toy Story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Think
correct.
So.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was also the highest grossing film of 1995. Wow, that is almost 20 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, last question. Orange Wedge, what whiskey-based liquor is mixed with cranberry and lime juices to make a Scarlet O'Hara?
What? Whiskey-based liquor. Oh, I mean, is it bourbon?
Bourbon.
Incorrect.
No, is it a whiskey-based?
Whiskey-based?
Liqueur? Liquor.
Is mixed with what now?
Cranberry and lime juices to make a Scarlet O'Hara, which is Southern.
What's a whiskey? Brandy?
No.
That's why we said bourbon.
Yeah. Southern.
The answer is Southern Comfort.
So Southern Comfort is not
whiskey, but it's
whiskey based.
Yeah, I knew it was its own little thing.
SoCo's one of those kind of alcohol that doesn't really.
You gotta mix it with lime.
Well, with Karen. And I actually have one challenge trivia question for everybody, but mostly directed towards Colin. Jay Kramer, an 11-year-old, wrote in and asked us some sport trivia questions that he wrote. Which city has the most sports champion titles?
Ooh, most sports champion titles. Okay, well, I mean, just...
So, including MLB baseball, NBA basketball, NFL football, NHL hockey.
New York City?
So, like the Celtics are going to skew it toward Boston. The Red Wings are going to skew it toward Detroit. The Lakers are going to skew it toward L.A. I don't know. Boston's got football and hockey as well. Boston?
Chris is right. It is New York City.
Yeah. because like between like with the Yankees
and
the Giants, they got like 20. Is right, they got 20 something. Yeah.
New York City has 35 MLB champions.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Total number of 50 of the four major sports. Mm-hmm. Who? What city do you think is number two?
It's not Boston.
It's Boston.
Oh, okay.
Boston with 35 total.
Yeah.
Okay. And, so New York's
like
got the
half of those are the Celtics. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So number one, New York City, but most time in pub quiz, they will ask you for number two.
And
number
two. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Number two show up a lot.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody knows number one. What is number two? So
everyone except for Colin.
I know.
Everyone
Colin,
except for Colin.
Chris and I looked at each other like, yeah, hey, like, why'd you poop on our victory?
I know.
Like, any idiot.
as any functioning adult knows,
any monkey off the street. Yeah. Tell you. Like,
sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
I know it's okay.
On my Facebook. Oh, whew.
All right.
Well, all right. Thank you, Jay Kramer.
Thank you.
The other day, I was on the train and I was brainstorming topics for this week's episode, and I was like, "Oh, you know what? Like, I look around and everybody has their headphones on. Everybody's reading. Everybody has like something they're working on, something like on the go. You know, someone has a water bottle. Someone's probably listening to podcast or music and someone's reading a book. So I was like, oh, we should do an episode on things on the go, things we bring with us. So this week we're taking it to go.
I will start us off with a quiz called Drinks to Go.
Whoa.
Again.
Not one for the road.
Thinking of, you know, thought about it, but it's not all of that stuff in the car. So it's all around beverages that are portable in one way or another, situations where you might take a drink with you. I think you guys will figure out the theme as we go.
Designed for you to carry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Cup holders in cars.
Wow.
I mean, especially in America these days, you'd be hard pressed to buy a car that did not have at least one cup holder in it today.
I don't think I've ever seen a car without one.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it really started becoming the norm in the 90s. And that was when just hit, you know, peak cup holder was in the 1990s.
Yep.
By the end of the decade, I mean, most cars not only had one, but
in the 80s, it was definitely like, oh, you have a cup holder in your car. Yeah. That's cool.
It's a feature.
But now it's like that you must have cup holders all the time.
I remember when I was a kid, I mean, I guess they still sell these, but it wasn't uncommon to see the little, you buy the aftermarket cup holder that just hooks over the window.
On.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Auto manufacturers caught on. I think I can say that this reached its zenith with the 1997 Chevrolet Venture minivan. So, I want you to guess. We're going to go closest to, without going over. We'll do Price is Right.
Sure.
How many cup holders came in the 1997 Chevrolet Venture?
Okay.
I will tell you that it was the most number at that time that had ever been put into a American vehicle. It was a minivan.
All right. Okay.
Let's just go around with your guesses.
Right. Okay.
15.
I'm going to guess 11.
I was going to guess 12.
Karen is closest.
Really?
Okay.
The 97 Chevy Venture had 17 cup holders.
Wow.
For a vehicle that seats 8 people.
Oh, what?
Two drinks.
Yes.
Drinks per person?
Yeah.
I was thinking it was one of those minivans that has three rows of rear seating, and they're not a minivan, but you know, like three rows of seating, three people in each row gets you to 9, and then 10, 11 for the two front seats, but no.
Don't forget on the car sides too. So not only cup holders in the middle.
So of course
side.
You need to be able to put your drink on the left or your right. Of course.
Yeah, so you could be safely hydrated. There's a drink, no matter where you were, a drink within arm's reach.
That's right.
Let me start with a little story here on this next question.
Cool.
The first time I ever went on an extended hiking trip, I think I was about 13. I was away at sleepaway camp, you know, so we were going off into the wilderness for a few days. And
he never came back.
And
then who was podcast?
Then who was podcast? And part of the fun of the trip was, you know, we were allowed to pack everything we wanted. We could take whatever we wanted because we're all carrying our own bags. And it was basically on us, you know. They encouraged us to pack, to bring a lot of water. Mm-hmm. You need to stay hydrated, especially when your kid's out and, you know, hiking around the wilderness. So, you know, I loaded up like 6 canteens full of water, put them in my, you know, because like I didn't want to get too hydrated.
Exactly. Yeah,
I wanted to be prepared. Aww. So I threw the bag on my back and I realized, holy crap, water's really heavy. The water's, like, really heavy. Yeah. So I took a few of them out. All of this to lead up to my question to you guys. How much does a gallon of water weigh?
Oh.
And I can see Chris's gears turning because he knows a secret mnemonic that might help him here.
I do know the secret mnemonic. I just can't remember how many.
I just can't remember the mnemonic.
Yes.
All right, Chris, you want to take a stab at it?
A gallon of water weighs...
Stalling. Oh, my God.
8 pounds.
You are very close, yes. Oh. Okay. Eight and a third pounds.
Okay. Yeah. Can I have the W on that one?
Absolutely.
All right.
And, Chris, I think you were the one who mentioned the mnemonic on our show.
I may have.
Of a pint's a pound, the world around.
That's right. So it was just a question of me remembering how many pints are in a gallon.
Yeah. So eight and a third pounds, for you scientifically minded listeners, at standard temperature and pressure.
You can use those as weights then.
Yeah, you could.
Sure.
Yeah. The thermos beverage container was introduced in 1904. And of course, the main selling point of the thermos is it keeps hot liquids hot, keeps cold liquids cold. Mm-hmm. But tell me, how does a thermos work? Karen.
Oh. Buzzing in?
Oh, I didn't know. Oh,
okay. Go for it.
That's fine.
There is a vacuum space between the container that has the liquid and then the outer container. There's a vacuum.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And it serves as insulation.
Glass and metal, right?
Yeah, often glass. It can be metal and metal. It can be, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, the key...
I don't think they use glass anymore for...
They don't for most. Yeah.
Right, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Just for safety reasons.
The point is... It's not the thing. It's the absence of the thing.
Yep. The original vacuum flask is commonly called a Dewar flask after James Dewar, Scottish scientist, who basically invented the modern design for it and sort of shared the design with the founders of thermos. He didn't want like patent or anything on it. He's like, here you go. Here's this cool thing.
Wow.
This is nature.
This is interesting. I did, as a side note, I learned thermos has become a genericized trademark.
No, really?
Yeah. In the 60s, it was declared.
Oh, really?
So wow. like aspirin or Zipper, it's you
wow.
can call
Xerox.
You can call a
no, not
flag.
Xerox.
Xerox
oh,
is not
Xerox.
Yeah, Xerox, yeah. Xerox and Velcro are ones that are not.
Right.
They're fighting hard
I thought
to keep
that,
it.
That's very interesting. I thought that thermos had successfully fended it off thus far, but
yeah,
apparently
yeah,
not.
That's what I read.
Wow.
All right, last one here. This beverage brand, named after an Italian island, was introduced in 1969. And has been known from the beginning for its distinctive packaging.
Oh.
Capri Sun.
Capri Sun. Yes. Yes.
Distinctive packaging. Yeah.
I had always assumed this was a total American invention. It's not. It was German originally.
I bet it was named for
Germans.
The pants.
They make good
for
stuff.
The short pants.
Capri.
Yeah.
No.
Is that Tetra Pak?
It's not a Tetra Pak. It's like a foil pouch.
It's a bag.
Yeah.
It's a bag of
it was
drink.
A foil bag. Yeah. Rudolf Wild of Germany, the Wild Company, he specifically wanted to sell a drink with novel packaging. Like, that was his goal.
So that was the whole point was
he's like, I want to come out with something that has packaging that no one's ever seen before, and this will be its selling point.
Screw efficiency.
Genius.
It's so true.
So it's not even like there was a special reason for the packaging. He just wanted to make the craziest packaging.
That's awesome. Apparently, a packaging salesman showed him the pouch. He's like, that's it. There's my container.
It just doesn't even taste that good, but it is fun. Like, everybody's
right,
had
right,
it.
Right.
I had so much Capri Sun as a kid. Yeah. Yeah.
Juice.
Yeah.
The original Capri Sun. No.
I
learned they are very proud of the fact that all the original Capri Suns were all natural. Like, that was one of their main selling points.
Original.
All natural ingredients.
Okay. Sure.
What about
Well, you
these
know what
days?
Else is? Yeah, Castoreum exactly. is also all natural.
That's right. Just have this mental image of somebody holding up a beaver and just squeezing it, going into a bag marked Capri Sun. Just on an assembly
all
line.
All natural.
Put a straw in the beaver butt.
Right, yeah. That, now that's original packaging.
Very nice. Cool.
I have an excerpt from a New York Times article from 1980. Here we go. Josh Lansing and the young blonde woman he had never even met before, but as they passed each other on Madison Avenue the other afternoon, she waved and smiled, and he tipped his headphones in salute. This, it should be understood, is not your stereotypical pickup. It was rather a stereophonic encounter. What the two well-dressed strangers first noticed about each other was that they were both possessors of the newest status symbol around town, the Walkman, a portable stereo unit priced in most stores at $200, consisting of an ultralight headphone set plugged into a cassette player that weighs in at less than 14 ounces, batteries included. It's just like Mercedes-Benz owners honking when they pass each other on the road, explained Lansing.
Yeah,
his cassette hung from his Gucci belt. The woman was strapped around perfectly tan shoulders. That's just a little taste of the people at the cutting edge of personal audio entertainment.
Wow, the Walkman.
The Walkman. It was released publicly in Japan in 1979. One of the leaders of Sony didn't like the name Walkman. He hated the name Walkman, but they'd already started promoting it.
So
it was in America, it was called the Soundabout for a moment. They went to Walkman, Discman. It was such a big deal.
Such a big deal.
I mean, listening to some of these people, it's kind of the complaints against Google Glass now. It's so interesting.
Oh, like people think they're D-bags?
Totally.
Just like Mercedes-Benz owners honking at each other.
Right. Where,
it's like an ostentatious status symbol when you're the very first one.
You really need to be like out and about in public listening to your own private music.
Yeah.
But the idea was just like, oh, well, I mean, why are you doing that? It's ridiculous.
There you go. It's the thinking man's box was the opinion of a man in a pinstripe suit who said he was listening to a business meeting I missed and my secretary taped.
Again, you know, prior to this, like, music was very much like, you know, it was a piece of furniture in your house, you know? Yeah. Like,
I love this one. Mark Levasco takes his Walkman plus a backpack of cassettes when he goes discoing. When he goes discoing, if I don't like the DJ's choice of music, he said, I play my own and I'm happy.
Yeah. dancing to your own music.
Yeah.
That did not.
Okay. Yeah. And then my
backpack full of cassette tapes.
That was my favorite. The Walkman, even the cassette Walkman, they stopped producing them in Japan just in 2010. They still make them in the United States.
Mm. Whoa.
Well, I mean, how many cassettes do you have?
How else are you supposed to play those tapes now?
Right. It's also probably just so cheap at this point, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yep.
And talk about, like, you know, names becoming genericized. Like, I remember as a kid, any grown-up, like, to a grown-up, any portable device was a Walkman.
It didn't matter what manufacturer
it was. I'm sure that just killed Sony. I'm sure they hated that.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had, like, the Walkman, the Discman, the whatever, man. But now Walkman is their CD one.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Like, all of them are just Walkman.
They're just Walkman. That's right.
I guess that makes sense. They were smart enough to have tape in the name or cassette.
Yep.
Oh, back to Google Glass. Mm-hmm. Do you know what people who are new to the Google Glass, who are the first of the Google Glass,
I know what people call them, but I don't know what they call themselves.
They call themselves, like, pioneers, right?
Explorers.
Oh,
they call themselves explorers. That's a trivia question.
Explorers? Okay.
Yeah.
I know what other people call them.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Things not...
It rhymes with glass bowl.
Yeah.
Sure.
Have you guys tried them yet?
No.
I know you have.
I have. Oh, you have?
I've never tried them.
Yeah, they're fine.
It's so useful that I think when it becomes mass market price, you're gonna start seeing it, whether it's shaped like Google Glass or whether it's something else that's built into eyeglasses or other kind of headwear. Like, I think we'll start seeing more of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about the Jawbone. And I feel like the Jawbone also got kind of, everybody was using it. And
the Bluetooth that everybody had. Yep. But then it stopped, right?
They stopped.
People stopped talking on the phone.
Yeah.
People started texting everything via, it was really, that was a weird era for me because you stopped being able to tell who was a crazy person on the street ranting about conspiracy theories and who was just like, on a business call.
Ranting about conspiracy.
Well, yeah. Right. Well, if we're going to talk about the Walkman, we should probably also discuss the Game Boy. Yes. I'm pretty sure, I mean, nobody ever from Nintendo ever said, yes, we named our portable video game machine the Game Boy to take a little dig at Sony's Walkman, but that's probably
where it
came from.
Do you think it was a dig
from.
Or like, this will make marketing easier?
A playful
Let's do this.
Sort of, yeah.
I thought it was a great name, though.
It is a great
until
name.
You said
awesome
that,
name.
I never thought about that. Yeah. Really? Until you said that.
Walkman, Game Boy. Portable video games are very big business for Nintendo. In fact, depending on how you count it, it's their biggest business. Nintendo has sold 273 million home video game machines, like the Super Nintendo or the GameCube or the Wii. Nintendo has sold just under 400 million portable gaming machines.
Wow.
So it far and away exceeds the number of home gaming machines that Nintendo has
sold. If you have two kids, you buy one console, but you need two portable ones.
And then they hit you with upgrades. So the Game Boy, as with many early Nintendo games and creations, was primarily considered to be the child of Gunpei Yokoi, who was one of Nintendo's engineers. He had been with the company. I mean, he was a mechanic working on the machines where they were making playing cards and toys all throughout their transformation from playing cards in the 1800s, you know, into toys, into electronic toys, into video games. And his philosophy, I'm going to speak some Japanese here, so get ready for this.
Okay. Oh.
He had distilled his philosophy for product or, you know, inventions down into this phrase, which is kareta gijutsu no suihei shiko. And that is lateral thinking with withered technology. Withered technology, or seasoned technology, sometimes translated up as withered, as a plant withers. Technology that has withered. So basically what this means is taking cheap stuff, taking technology that's already been used, that's no longer cutting edge, but using it in a unique way. This explains a lot of what Nintendo has done with video games. I mean, this is the philosophy of the Wii, which used old, like, technology that was 5 years old, but in a different way.
Maxing it out or just...
One major example of this was one day in the late 70s, Yokoi was riding the Shinkansen, and he saw a businessman playing to kill time, playing with an LCD calculator. Just pressing the buttons, watching things happen. The LCD calculator was hot stuff in the early 80s. Yeah. I mean, there was the LCD calculator. Yeah. Everybody had to have an LCD calculator, whether you needed it or not. It was just so cool.
It's true. It's true.
And the technology at that point was really cheap because of economy of scale. Everybody wanted one, so they were making tons and tons of these LCD screens.
Just to clarify, this is a calculator, right?
Calculator.
Okay. I was transfixed with the LCD calculator, but I was a very little kid, so it was just like, whatever.
I didn't know what versions of calculator came before that.
Were there other ones?
Well, there were like mechanical calculators.
That one sounds good.
The handheld,
or like an abacus, there were calculators that use like, I remember like plastic calculators that used entirely mechanical,
like gears and stuff.
Yeah, like you punch the numbers in and it would turn gears and add things up for
amazing.
You.
That's amazing. I want one of those.
Steampunk.
But LCD calculators, big deal. So this is how Gunpei Yokoi invented the Game End Watch, which was the LCD screen, right? They only played one game, but the screen was a calculator. You know, the calculator just caused certain areas of the LCD screen to light up to show numbers, but they just used it for like stick figures and balls and things like that. And,
you know, aliens
Kong
dropping
and Mario and Donkey Kong and whatever, right? And he also invented the what is called the D-pad. The cross pad that used to control things, which eventually would end up on the Nintendo Entertainment System and the Game Boy. Right. Because they needed something that wasn't a joystick
to
control
on that.
Things.
Yeah.
Up, down, left, and right.
And Nintendo still has the patent on that, so that's why nobody else can, like, legally,
really?
You see, I mean, the PlayStation has it, but it's slightly different to get around the patent, because the PlayStation, you notice it's, like, four separate buttons. That's getting around Nintendo's patent of that plus design.
Oh, that's really nice. Interesting. Yep.
Every time somebody makes a new video game system and they want to do that, they have to, like, come up with their own, like, slight different take on it. Yeah, with, like, the Xbox, it, you know, for the Xbox 360's pad was, like, this weird kind of of like, it was almost like a joystick.
Circle.
It was like, it would be a circle.
Yeah.
So a decade later, after making Game & Watch in the early, early part of the 80s, Nintendo applies this lesson of, you know, let's use withered technology in a novel way. I mean, computer sizes had shrunken so much at that point that like it was becoming possible to make a portable video game machine. In fact, it was totally possible, late 80s, early 90s, to do a portable game machine that had a color screen that was roughly equivalent in power to, like, you know, the home video game consoles that were on the market. It, you know, you could even put a 16-bit graphics chip in there and do some really cool stuff. And a lot of gaming hardware makers all kind of had the same idea at the same time. But the difference with what Nintendo did was their priority was not, let's make this thing super powerful and knock your socks off. It was, let's make it inexpensive. Let's give it the most battery life that we can possibly give it. So Nintendo's competitors, early competitors in the portable gaming space, Sega's Game Gear, the Atari Lynx, the Turbo Express, they had beautiful graphics, they had color screens, they were battery vampires. You would put six AAAs into a Sega Game Gear, and it would there were two separate battery compartments, three batteries and three batteries, and they'd be dead in like a couple of hours. So if you're a kid, like, you know, constantly having to like get more batteries, that's a huge expense, right? And if you're a parent, it's like, I don't want to give you all these batteries. Nintendo, four AA batteries in the original Game Boy, 15 to 20 hours
of gameplay. Yeah, it was a while.
You get tons of gameplay out of it.
Yeah, that's like a whole plane flight and a plane flight back.
Exactly.
I remember.
Up and down the Eastern Seaboard. Yeah. Right?
But once that red light comes on, you're like,
oh. No, the red light comes on, you're like, oh no, I've only got an hour left out of these things where I gotta swap the batteries. Yeah. The screen, I mean, a lot of this was due to the screen. It was not color. It was not even, it was four shades of gray, basically, is what the screen could do. It had no backlight. So, I mean, like, famously, you had to, like, shine lights on it and make sure you got the right angle. And then instead of costing anywhere between, like, you know, $150 to $200, it cost $89.99. It wasn't even $99.99. It was $89.99. And it came with Tetris. So you get a free game with your $89.99. It was so cheap. They sold millions, you know, between Japan, the U.S., and Europe, just, like, took off like a rocket. They really aimed it, if you look at the original Game Boy ads, they aimed it at, like, business people, you know, because they knew kids were probably going to buy it, so they targeted the ads at, like, oh, are you on this cross-country LA to New York long-haul flight? Well, why don't you play golf on your Game Boy? I mean, even when it became feasible to do color graphics with good battery life, Game Boy was such a runaway train that it was just impossible to compete with it, and it just kept going and going and going. Just as Game Boy started to slow down a little, you know, just as people started to stop buying Game Boys, Nintendo, in the craziest stroke of genius and luck, released Pokemon. The first Pokemon games were released in Japan in February 1996. This was a huge shock. The Game Boy, apparently, prior to Pokemon, the Game Boy, according to one source I found, the year prior, they had shipped a million Game Boys in Japan. Like, that's great. The year following that release of Pokemon, 3 million Game Boys. And it just took off again. And like, eventually, Nintendo did have to bow to market pressures and release a Game Boy with a color screen and better technology. But they released the Game Boy Color in the year 1998. So Nintendo got almost 10 years of black and white graphics of the old Game Boy hardware, thanks in part to Pokemon reviving it.
And again, like the Walkman, I remember as a kid, to a grown-up, any handheld gaming system is a Game Boy.
That's right.
Absolutely. If it's electronic and you're playing it, it's Game Boy. My dad will still, to this day, any handheld, are you playing on your Game Boy or something there? Yeah.
Yep.
It's still.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Cute.
It was just cemented.
That's such a dad thing.
Yeah.
That's so funny. All right. Let's take a quick break. A word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So I want to tell a story about a certain invention, and this object was invented in 1894 in America, and it was called the oyster pail. Very easy to make, very cheap to make, just a little paper bucket, and it's supposed to, you know, a pail, you're supposed to carry it like upright. So there were oyster stands. If you wanted oyster, you go to the fish market and to the oyster stand. And the thing is, they have, the people who are selling them, not only are they selling it to you, they're also preparing it. They would shuck the oyster for you, cause that's hard to do it by yourself. And then they would put all the shucked oysters in the oyster pail for you to take it to go back home.
Okay.
So in the mid 20th century, the price of oysters went up because of overfishing. So now a lot of these manufacturers have all these oyster pails that are unused.
Okay.
Kind of stocking up. Also in the mid 20th century after World War II, there was a huge increase in prepared foods that can be purchased from restaurants. And at this time, especially post-war, Chinese food became really, really, really big. And so the oyster pail was quickly adopted for Chinese takeout. The oyster pail is that iconic Chinese takeout
the
box.
The white little foldy white cardboard.
Yep.
You are blowing my mind.
Yes. Not Asian.
Yeah.
Totally U.S. invention and for oysters. And it was actually really great for Chinese food because Chinese food usually is very saucy, oily, hot.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just like a sandwich box or something. It really can hold weird stuff, I guess, weird textured stuff.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's not a burger or a sandwich or a pizza. This became the iconic Chinese food takeout box.
And so this is what, like 1940s, 1950s?
Yep. And so I was looking into dishes that you'd see in Chinese food places here in America and kind of looking around at the origin to see if they're really Chinese or if they're U.S. Made up or pseudo Chinese or part Chinese. The poo-poo platter. Do you know what is the poo-poo platter?
Yeah, it's appetizer. It's like, or not appetizers, but like it's,
or like
it's
a variety it's like platter.
A variety platter. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Isn't it Hawaiian?
It is Hawaiian.
Oh, okay.
The poo-poo platter, probably first introduced to the States during, you know, the tiki craze. The Polynesia craze.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the poop craze, which lasted 1968, slightly later in 1968, before being quickly abandoned. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, you can say it might be kind of Chinese inspired because there are Chinese people living in Hawaii, but really in Hawaii, poo poo is kind of like canapes or little bites, little bits of food, kind of all together.
P-U-P-U, right?
Yeah, P-U-P-U. There is a Chinese name for it, but it, I think it's like a acronym or like a retcon.
Oh, okay.
Right, but poo poo is from Hawaiian.
How many times can we get away with saying
crab rangoon? See crab rangoon in a lot of appetizers.
Yeah. Are you Karen? Are you going to sit here and tell me, ruin my entire life and tell me that imitation crab and Philadelphia cream cheese is not authentic Chinese food that I've been eating a lie every Tuesday night for my entire life?
One of the first places to serve crab rangoon is Trader Vic's.
Yeah.
Speaking of tiki craze.
Really?
Uh-huh.
I want to go there now.
We have a gift certificate
because
Mai Tais were invented there.
Yep.
Yeah.
And crab rangoon?
That was Oakland.
That's Oakland. All I eat and or drink. Mai Tai crab rangoon, Mai Tai crab rangoon. Yeah. I'm passed out by 1 p.m.
Chris has gout and
scurvy.
Yeah.
Not a Chinese thing, crab rangoon.
Not to mention, like, rangoon is not in China. I don't want to be too much of a nitpicker.
The sources
say
that, like, it's based on maybe a Burmese recipe, but cream cheese and imitation crab.
Cheese, the cream cheese is the giveaway.
Chinese chicken salad, not Chinese either.
What?
Yeah. Came out in 1960s, kind of in the salad, you know, Hollywood.
Oh, really? That
exotic,
early?
Exotic phase. There was a restaurant in Santa Monica called Madame Wu's. Had a, like, this is kind of your pan-Asian or Californian-Asian kind of entry. There are salads, and there's chicken in the salads in Chinese cuisine, but not the chicken salad. There's one thing I have to talk about I've never heard before and so interesting called yucca mane. Yucca mane.
Yucca mane.
Like mane as in like low mane or chow mane.
Okay.
Yucca mane. It is a Chinese Creole mashup local food item in New Orleans.
Whoa. That's awesome.
What's in it?
In Taiwanese and Chinese cooking, there's beef noodle soup, which is very, very iconic. This is a kind of a Creole American take on beef noodle soup where the noodle is spaghetti.
Okay.
And the soup is stewed beef, like brisket. And then, the broth has Cajun seasoning and bay leaves and chili powder. And there's like a hard boiled egg and green onions.
Oh man. That so it's like, tasty. It's New Orleans ramen basically.
Yeah, it is.
Oh
it
my
is.
God. Can somebody send some to us?
I think you could probably make it yourself.
Yeah.
They talk about how this is a great hangover cure.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, sure.
Yeah.
Everything is right.
Right.
Exactly. It's spicy and it's hot and it's reminiscent of a Chinese beef noodle soup. Yucca mane.
I want to go to New Orleans and I want to eat yucca mane.
Yucca mane.
We were just watching Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern, and there was an episode he was in Lima, Peru. Uh-huh. And apparently there's a large group of ethnic Chinese and Japanese people who in Lima have like established Peruvian Chinese food, you know, or Chinese Peruvian food or Peruvian Japanese food. Chifa is the name for like Chinese food. It's very much the same way. It's like, yeah, it's mashup. It's done to their tastes.
Mm. That's cool. Yep. So there you go. Some 411 on Chinese American food. Yeah. Probably the most popular takeout food. Oh, and also the oyster pail.
Yeah.
I don't know what the normal name is called. Chinese takeout food box.
Like I would just call it a Chinese. Like if I had to do like carton? A stock image search, I would just search Chinese food carton or so. Carton.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I live in America. and having to walk into a restaurant and take a takeout container is too hard. Too inefficient.
Okay.
So I would like to talk about that wonderfully American of inventions, the drive-through window. Now, we shall begin by defining our terms, especially if you do not live in America like me and have some other funny word for it, like Cockney rhyming slang or what. A drive-through window on a restaurant is distinct from a drive-in restaurant. A drive-in is a restaurant that does not have indoor seating. You drive your car into the parking lot. The waiter or car hop comes to your car, takes your order, brings your food to your car, you eat it in the car. This was from an era in which everyone was in love with their car.
Yeah.
And eating in your car sounded like the coolest thing.
I associate it very, very 50s in my mind.
Yeah.
Indeed. So with a drive-through window, the restaurant inside may or may not have a inside seating area, but basically instead of even having to get out of your car, you pull up to the window, pay for and get your food, and then importantly, drive off with your food. You don't sit there and eat it in the parking lot.
You can
if you really want to, but if you're going to do that, why don't you just go inside?
Exactly.
Here's your food. Get out. Here's your burger. Now get out. As memorialized in the name of the fast food place, In-N-Out Burger.
Yes.
There are a lot of different places that claim to have invented the drive-through window, but In-N-Out, the burger chain here in California and elsewhere, has a pretty solid claim to the invention of the modern-day drive-through window, which is intercom-based. You place your order into a speaker, they take your order, you drive up to the window, you pay, you drive up to the next window, they hand you your food, and then again, importantly, in and out. The original In-N-Out, built in 1948, had no inside seating and no parking lot. So very, very clear. Come here. Here's your burger.
Get out.
Don't care where you go with it. You can't stay here.
Because there's someone right in line behind you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow, that's actually really efficient because then you don't have to pay that much for property, like area property.
That's the thing.
Real estate.
Super efficient. You can serve more people. I mean, you know, you're not paying for a lot of stuff. Yeah, exactly. Now, other burger chains began to add in drive-through windows. After In-N-Out, Jack in the Box, was sort of an early kind of jumper honor with the drive-through windows. Wendy's. So let me ask you this. Another Brad Pitt or Lasers, which is older question. Which is older? McDonald's drive-through or Colin?
Oh.
McDonald's drive-thru or Colin?
I don't actually know how old Colin is.
Colin that is 67 part of the- years old.
I'll
say Colin.
McDonald's. If you had asked me just to name the year, I would have guessed much earlier. But I'm going to lean with Karen. I'll guess that I'm older than McDonald's drive-thru.
Yeah, I'll tell you. So In-N-Out was founded in 1948. McDonald's was originally a barbecue restaurant in the 1940s, and they converted over into fast food service burger place in 1948, same year. So really, it's asking you how long it's for Colin, especially because I'm pretty sure he knows what year he was born. How long did it take McDonald's to put the drive-thru window? Was it before or after?
I'm going to switch McDonald's, but not by much.
I say McDonald's.
Colin, you are older than McDonald's drive-thru window.
Wow.
Colin was born in 1974. The first McDonald's drive-thru window was installed in 1975.
Wow.
It took him a long time. The impetus was there was a McDonald's in Sierra Vista, Arizona, and it was near a military base. The military men could not get out of their cars while they were still in fatigues. Like they could drive off the base, but they couldn't get out of their cars. So they put in a drive-thru window at the McDonald's. By 1988, McDonald's was doing 51% of its business through the drive-thru window. If you think about it, on average, they were serving one car every 25 seconds at the drive-thru window. So you think people don't have to come in. They don't have to sit down.
Oh,
none of that stuff. The car comes up. You sell them the food. Yeah. They leave. Nowadays, it's more like 60 to 70% of the business of a McDonald's with the drive-thru is done out the window.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Here's another question for you guys. If today, if you have, let's say you're driving along the highway on a road trip, you want to get a drive-thru, but you want your food the fastest.
Oh.
Of the major burger places, where would you go if you wanted the fastest food?
Fastest.
Oh, that's a good question.
Wow,
I like this.
That is good.
So I'm gonna guess In-N-Out. I'm gonna guess that they mastered it.
I don't think so. I think they cook it.
Yeah.
And
Burger King. Do they still do it your way? Because that takes a while.
Oh, so maybe it's the place that has the fewest options, like White Castle.
Wendy's
or something.
Is very fast. I think.
So QSR. Quick Serve Restaurants, it is the trade industry publication for the fast food business, does an annual drive-thru study. And in 2013, they found that the fastest of what they surveyed was Wendy's.
Wow.
Yeah. Wendy's had an average time of 133 seconds from order to payment to food. 133 seconds. The slowest. Chick-fil-A was over 200 seconds. Now, that's still not a long time. That's still super fast to get your food. Mm-hmm. But if that extra minute counts, USA Today reported last year, coming off the back of this survey, that actually the drive-through waiting times in general are actually getting longer and longer and longer. Does anybody want to guess why?
People are slow. The menus are too complicated.
That's two answers. Yeah. Which one do you want to pick?
Like, and they're related. You have to read. There are a lot of options. And
true. The answer is, in fact, menu bloat. Yeah. And it's not only the fact that there's more options on the menu.
Yeah.
To attract more customers, fast food places are making more and more complicated dishes at this point, with all kinds of different ingredients that have to be
fajita,
put on.
Fajitas
and salad bowls that are custom handmade, and all this wraps and all kinds of stuff where it's not just like burger, fries, and a Coke anymore. But to hear the QSR magazine tell it, customers actually aren't concerned as much with speed as they are with, what do you think the big one is for drive-thru customers?
For me, it's accuracy. They better get that order right.
I get
so mad when they get the order wrong.
You are absolutely correct.
Because you're driving away. You're not going to drive back and be like, you gave me the
wrong. Colin drives back. Colin drives back if
they
get the order
and
wrong.
Right, and you're going to be super ticked off, like more so than if you had been waiting an extra 30 seconds for the order. So actually, one of the things that people really, that these companies really work on is accuracy. If you go and get drive-through at Burger King, you need to check that bag. Burger King, of the companies tested, had the lowest accuracy score, 82.5% accuracy rating. That means that nearly one-fifth of the time you go to Burger King, they're giving you the wrong order.
B-minus.
You need to look in that bag.
Good to know.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
All right, and we have one quick quiz segment, Dana.
All right, I don't know how we could have an episode about portable things, how we can have an episode about portable things.
Just people in general.
No,
but
us specifically, and not have something about the porta potty.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Portaloo, Portajohn. Mm-hmm. Okay. So,
it's, oh, do they say Portaloo in England?
They do.
Portaloo?
Oh,
Portaloo.
Yeah.
That's so cute. Mm. Portaloo.
Sounds like a music festival.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So which toilet cubicle in a row of Portaloos is the least used on average?
Oh,
which one should you go to if you want
to
clean
it? I've read this before.
In bathrooms, it is the one closest to the door.
Oh.
So I'm going to go ahead and guess it's like the one that's closest to the line full of people that are waiting there.
It is the
first
one.
First one?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
I think because people don't want to do it right next to the line. Right.
If you had a choice, you'd move further away from everybody.
That says a lot about like human psychology.
So that's all. Yeah. And the same. It's the same thing in a bathroom.
So it's, I've heard that with urinals.
The cleanest, urinal, the cleanest toilet.
So the easiest to get to is not the one that's picked or the shortest. Yeah.
Right. No, people want to get far away.
Yeah. You want to go deep into the woods to take care of your business.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
How many portable toilets were at Obama's inauguration?
Oh my God. Oh, multiple choice?
I'll give you multiple choice. Because, mean, how could you figure it out? 1,000, 5,000, or 15,000?
15,000.
Whatever you said, I was going to pick the highest one. So I'm going to stick with that.
It's 5,000.
Oh.
What am I? Like, I'm just going to give you 5,000. That's a lot of, that's more than a music festival.
That's a lot. You know, music festival, if somebody pees against a tree, okay.
Yeah.
Obama's inauguration, if like Joe Biden is like, you know,
because he's the one you're worried about.
It's like, I can't find a Portajohn. You don't want that.
Keeping it classy.
Exactly.
Okay. In the 1940s in Long Beach, California, the forerunner of the modern portable toilet was born. So that way workers in this industry could stay on the job longer. Okay. What industry? Long Beach, California in 1940s.
I'll guess dock workers.
Shipbuilders. The first.
Shipbuilder.
Shipbuilders.
Go back.
Ship.
No, it's a family show. People who build large boats.
Ships.
Shipbuilders.
Yeah, it was a heavy wooden box with a metal inside. So there's privacy and it was portable. They can move it around. Unfortunately, like wood starts to smell bad after a while. Metal is hard to clean. So they tried like different types of materials.
Right. Sponge was a terrible idea. The less said about it, the better. Yeah.
So, here's one. Brad Pitt or porta potties. The first patent on the porta potty or Brad Pitt, which is older?
The first patent on the porta potty.
So we know. Brad Pitt was 63. Brad Pitt, I believe, was born 63.
I'll say Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt is older.
I'll say porta potty.
It's porta potty. It was 62. It was right before Brad Pitt.
Is that like what constructed of plastic or fiberglass?
Yes.
Fiberglass
holds smell. So it was plastic. Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
They figured out the plastic in 62. Okay. True or false? There is a medically recognized word to describe a fear of porta potties.
Oh.
A fear of porta potties.
True. Absolutely true.
I wish it were true.
No.
I looked so hard and there isn't, but there's specific fears of poop, of pee,
public.
But there's no specific one for that.
For porta potties.
Everybody wants one.
Can we make up one? What would you say? Fear of porta. Oh.
We can make one up. You know what?
Yeah.
Everyone.
This is the mission.
Feel free to submit your ideas.
In the comments or
Facebook. It's got to be Greek, right?
Yeah.
So Greek words.
Not Latin, Greek.
Greek. So Greek words for toilet or possibly like the
outside,
act.
Public
or
toilet.
An outside.
Fear.
Public.
May I suggest claustrophobia?
You may not.
Okay.
All right. So you can suggest it, but we'll keep looking around. There was like Somebody had portophobia, but they're like, is that a fear of ports? That doesn't sound right.
It has to be everything altogether. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, and then the last one. According to the BBC, which British monarch used a portable toilet that was shaped like a box covered with red velvet, trimmed with lace, and with a lid and with carrying handles?
Do they have those on Amazon?
Old school. I would assume old school.
Which British monarch?
With that, like a carrying thing?
Yeah.
I'm going to guess it's going to be a queen. I can't imagine, like, Henry VIII would care about this.
I think it's Henry VIII.
So I was going to guess, like,
okay.
I'm going to say Queen Victoria.
Henry VIII.
Is Elizabeth one.
Okay.
So in 1596, Sir John Harrington introduced Queen Elizabeth to the first flushing toilet.
Yes.
So Harrington. This is fascinating trivia to me, probably to you guys too, but Kit Harrington, Jon Snow, is a descendant
of
Sir John Harrington.
Holy cow.
Oh my god.
So you might say he has a claim to the throne.
Oh yes, wow.
That's it. And the show is over.
Wow.
Yeah, he knows something. Okay, yeah, mic drop. All right, we're going to end the show now. That was awesome. thank you guys for joining me. Thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot of stuff about portable things, Walkman, Game Boy, Jon Snow, Chinese food, and portable drinks, and more. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. Thanks to our sponsor, Audible, and we'll see you guys next week.
Bye. Bye.
Spend less time staying in the know about all things gaming and more time actually watching and playing what you want with the IGN Daily Update podcast. All you need is a few minutes to hear the latest from IGN on the world of video games, movies, and television with news, previews, and reviews. So listen and subscribe to the IGN Daily Update wherever you get your podcasts. That's the IGN Daily Update wherever you get your podcasts.